time to explain. The Meisters were close.
"I'm crazy and you're fat," Fiir said.
But he picked up Solon and put him on his back.
"Magically, too. I've got a plan, and I'm not fat."
For all that he second-guessed plans when they were all safe, Fiir knew to obey in battle. He opened himself quickly, and Solon dipped into Fiir's talent. He lashed himself onto Fiir's back with magical bonds. Then he quickly readied 5 thin weaves. It still hurt, but not nearly as much as using his own talent.
"Now," he said, "jump!"
Fiir leaped over the side of the bridge. The rope was in the perfect place, not because of the wind or the power of prophecy, but because Solon pulled it there with magic. As Fiir grabbed the rope, Solon activated the other weaves. Holes were torn in the sides of each of the fire pots, and air inside them suddenly compressed, jetting the oil in the pots out onto the bridge. The last weave dropped a little spark in the middle of the oil. There was a satisfying whoosh. The river suddenly lit orange and white, and heat washed over the falling mages. Then, things were happening too rapidly to follow. Fiir had caught the rope with both hands and a leg. He immediately flipped upside down. The sudden change in direction caught Solon's arm across Fiir's shoulder and snapped it. If it weren't for the magical bonds holding him, he would have dropped like a stone. The rope, anchored on both sides of the bridge, first stretched, bowing down toward the middle. Because Fiir and Solon hadn't made it to the middle of the bridge, that meant they zipped head first for 15 paces. Then, the rope tore loose at the castle end. Solon watched light explode over them, distantly aware that they were swinging with terrific speed toward the river. The bridge was engulfed in flames, leaping merrily into the night. Or maybe that was pain exploding in his head. They had slapped into something cold and hard. He took a deep breath. It was bad timing. The cold, hard stuff had become cold, wet stuff. They were underwater. He coughed as Fiir came to the surface, and Solon thought dimly that the man was either a hell of a swimmer, or something was dragging them out. Fiir was on his knees in the shallows, holding up his hands. From his perch on the man's back, Solon saw that Fiir's hands had been torn to bloody pieces by the rope. He could see bone.
"Ah, you're better off than I thought you'd be," Dorian's voice was saying, as his magic hauled them out of the river. "Stop lollygagging, you two. We need to get going if we're going to make it to Calador in time."
"Lollygagging?"
Solon asked, glad to find that he had strength to be outraged.
"Calador?" Fiir said.
"Well, that's where my bride is waiting. I can't wait to find out who she is. I think Curoc is going to find its way there, too."
Fiir cursed, but Solon, broken arm, purple vision and all, just laughed. Chapter 65. As they came within the arc of his sword, or the reach of his lashing feet or striking fists, men went down like grain in a summer storm. To Kylar, who had always been gifted at fighting, battle suddenly made sense. The chaos unfolded into beautifully intricate, interlocking, and logical patterns. Just by looking at a man's face, he could judge instantly. Parry left, hesitate, lunge, clear. A man died and fell far enough away that he didn't impede Kylar's movements. Next, sweep right, roll in, bare fist to nose. Spin, hamstring, throat, parry, riposte, stab. Parsed to the individual percussion of each chamber of his heart, battle had a rhythm, a music. Not a sound was out of place. The tenor of ringing steel layered over a bass of the fists and feet hammering flesh, soft to hard, hard to soft, and the baritone of men's curses, punctuated by the staccato percussion of rending mail. With his talent singing, Kylar was a virtuoso. He fought in a fine frenzy, a dancer possessed. Time never slowed, but he found his body reacting to sights he didn't consciously see, turning, dodging under blows his mind never registered, striking with the awesome speed and grace of that angel of death, the Night Angel. The Highlanders sought to overwhelm him by force of numbers. Their blades caught the air within an inch of Kylar's ear, within half an inch of his stomach, a quarter of an inch from his thigh. He rode the front of each beat, cut the margins closer and closer, until the bodies he was killing were being pushed forward instead of falling back, and pressing in closer on him. He sheathed retribution, and grabbed the hand holding a blade aimed at his belly, and yanked a skinny Highlander across the circle to stab his fellow. Reaching around his own back with a knife, he diverted a sword thrust while his other knife found an eye socket. Two spears came for him, and he dropped to the floor, yanking both forward. As each impaled a body, he swung up, destroying another Highlander's face with a kick. But the situation was hopeless. Within a cage of tangled weapons and thrashing, dying men, he'd be trapped in moments. Light as a cat, he sprang to the back of a man dying on his knees and vaulted off the shoulder of one of the impaled spear-bearers. As he flipped sideways through the air, a ball of green witchfire the size of his fist streaked through the air at him. It caught his cloak and broke into pieces. He landed on his feet and ducked under a sword cut. His cloak burst into green flame. Kylar tore the cloak off as he dove between two spears. Holding one edge of the cloak, he came to his feet and wrapped the cloak around another of his attackers. The green flame raced for the man's skin, and there burned a fierce blue as he screamed. Another ball of witchfire sizzled through the air, and Kylar dove behind one of the pillars supporting the high ceiling. There were two beats of rest. Kylar had killed or disabled more than half the Kalidorans, but now the others played to their strengths. Point. Counterpoint.
"To the captain! Keep a Meister in view!"
Roth shouted. Men streamed to the captain to form a wedge between Kylar and Roth, who had retreated to the throne to watch. But Kylar wasn't wasting his time, as he stood in the protection of the pillar. He knew that if he wanted a chance at Roth, he had to kill the witches. Both of them were eyeing the spaces between the pillars where he would have to run. He pooled the Kakari in his hand, and keeping the feel of those fingers of magic in his mind, willed it to dribble down the length of his sword. Seeming to sense his urgency, the Kakari coated the steel instantly. Both Kakari and steel shimmered out of visibility. Kylar dodged out from the pillar, and the fingers were on him instantly. He cut in a quick circle and felt them shrivel and die out of existence. Grabbing the edge of one of the long tapestries that covered the walls of the throne room, Kylar moved toward the pillar, but not before witchfire leaped from a witch's fingers. If he'd had time to think about it, Kylar wouldn't have tried to block with his sword. It was insanity to try to block magic, but it was his ingrained response. The flat of his blade hit the green globe of fire. Instead of bursting, the fire whooshed into the blade. Kylar dodged around a pillar with the tapestry in one hand and a sword now visible because of the green flame crackling through it. With all the strength of his talent, he leaped. He soared into the air in the middle of the throne room, and then, as the tapestry met a pillar, it abruptly changed his trajectory and launched him up the steps. The other witch must have thrown witchfire that Kylar hadn't seen, because the tapestry gave way and tore a moment before Kylar was going to release it. He hit the landing between the flights of stairs with 8 feet of burning tapestry in his hands. He hurled it toward the Highlanders and slashed at the witch, chanting not 2 steps away. The top of the witch's head opened, exposing his brain. The man spun, but his lips completed his incantation. The thick black tendrils that had been squirming under the skin of his arms fattened grotesquely, like rippling muscles, and tore free of the witch's arms, bursting through his skin. Power roared from the dying witch, and he staggered, trying to find Kylar. Kylar jumped behind him. He kicked the witch so hard that the man lifted off the ground and crashed into the Highlanders. The flailing black tendrils ripped into the men, sucking them in like greedy hands and chewing through them with a sound like logs in a sawmill. Even as the black tendrils were tearing through the soldiers, Kylar felt, more than saw, the white light forming behind him. He turned in time to see the homunculus streaking through the air. It dodged under his desperate slash and stabbed tiny claws into his chest. He was already jumping to the side when he felt the concussion and saw the air ripple. Reality bubbled in a line toward him. The rippling air curved, following him as he ran. Then the air tore open. He vaulted all the way to the wall and nearly caught another ball of witchfire with his face. The pitworm lunged forward into reality, barely missing him. It thrashed, furious, tearing the hole open wider and hooking fiery claws around 2 of the pillars mere feet away. Kylar ripped the homunculus from his chest and slapped it onto a soldier's face. The pitworm lunged again. Kylar leapt straight up. Its lamprey-like mouth shot out, latched onto the screaming man, and sucked him back into the pit. By the time Kylar landed, both pitworm and soldier were gone. Kylar turned and jumped for the top of the stairs, but he was too slow. Even as he left the ground, he saw a blur of light streaking toward him. There was no time to draw a throwing knife. Kylar hurled his sword at the last witch. The bolt of magic blasted his left shoulder. As the momentum of his leap carried him up and forward, the blast made him flip end over end backward. He crunched into the marble floor at the foot of the throne and felt his left knee shatter. For a long moment, his eyes refused to focus. He blinked and blinked and finally cleared the blood away. He saw retribution buried to the hilt through a witch 10 paces away, its blade black with his kakari. He realized that he was viewing the dead witch through a pair of legs. His eyes followed the leg up to Roth's face. "Stand up," Roth said. He plunged his longsword through Kylar's lower back. Kylar gagged as Roth twisted the blade in his kidney. Then the hot metal lifted away. Something pulled Kylar to his feet. The pain was like a cloud making everything fuzzy and indistinct. Confused, Kylar stared at the dead witches. "Who picked me up?"
"All the Ethlings of God King or Sul are witch-born," Roth said. "Didn't you know?"
Kylar stared at Roth dumbly. Roth was talented? The invisible hands released him, and he folded as he put weight on his destroyed left leg. The marble floor jarred him once more.
"Get up," Roth said.
He stabbed Kylar's groin and cursed him. Kylar dropped his head onto the marble as Roth's screaming became inarticulate. The sound of Roth's voice faded to a murmur next to the roaring voice of pain. The pain flashed in another bar through his stomach as Roth stabbed him again. Then he must have picked Kylar up again, because Kylar felt his head lolling to one side. If he'd felt pain before, now it became agony. Every part of his body was being scoured with fire, dipped in alcohol, packed with salt. His eyelids were lined with crushed glass, His optic nerves were being chewed by little teeth, and after his eyes, every tissue, sinew, muscle, and organ marinated in misery in its turn. He was screaming, but his mind cleared. Kylar blinked. He was standing before Roth, and he was aware and dismayed. He must have landed on his left knee when he'd crashed to the marble, because it was demolished. He was bleeding inside, his intestines leaking slow death into his viscera, stomach acid scorching his intestines, a kidney pouring black blood. His left shoulder looked like it had kissed a giant's hammer.
"You won't die easy," Roth said. "I won't allow it. Not after what you've done. Look what you've done. My father will be furious."
There it was. He was dying. Kylar could perch unsteadily on his one good leg, but he had no weapons. His sword and the Kakari were 10 paces away. They might as well have been across the ocean. No weapons, and Roth was, even now, careful not to come within range of his hands. Kylar didn't have so much as a belt left.
"Are you ready to die?"
Roth said, his eyes glowing malevolence. Kylar was staring at his right hand. Of all the beaten, sliced, and smashed places on his body, his fingers were healthy. Perfect. Healed. Wasn't that the hand he'd cut on the window last night?
"I'm ready,"
he said, surprising himself.
"Any regrets?" Roth asked.
Kylar looked into Roth and understood him. Kylar had always had enough darkness in his soul to understand evil men. Roth was trying to wring anguish from him. Roth wanted to kill him while he thought of all the things he hadn't done. Roth reaped despair.
"Dying well is easy," Kylar said. "It only takes a moment of courage. It's living well that I couldn't do. What's death compared to that?"
"You're about to find out," Roth spat.
Kylar smirked, and then smiled as rage washed over Roth.
"Killing Logan was more fun," Roth said.
He rammed his sword into Kylar's chest. Logan. The thought cut through Kylar more cruelly than the sword in Roth's hand. Kylar had lived by the sword. Dying by it was neither unexpected nor unjust. But Logan had never even wanted to hurt anyone. Roth killing Logan wasn't right. It wasn't fair. It wasn't just. Kylar stared at the steel stabbed through his chest. He took Roth's hand in his own and pulled himself up the sword, impaling himself to the hilt. Roth's eyes widened.
"I am the Night Angel," Kylar said, gasping on the steel through his lung. "This is justice. This is for Logan."
There was a ting and the sound of metal rolling on marble. The Kakari leaped for Kylar's hand and was caught squarely by Roth. Triumph lit his eyes. He laughed. But Kylar grabbed Roth's shoulders and stared him in the eye.
"I am the Night Angel," Kylar repeated. "This is justice. This is for Logan."
Kylar lifted his right hand. Roth looked confused. Then he looked at his left hand. The Kakari was turning to liquid and gliding through his fingers. His hands scrambled as they'd scrambled across the wood floor of the boat shop and found nothing. The Kakari slapped into Kylar's palm and formed an enormous punch dagger on his fist. Kylar slammed his fist into Roth's chest. Roth looked down his disbelief turning to horror as Kylar drew the dagger out, his horror turning to fear as his heart pumped blood directly into his lungs. Roth shrieked, a shrill denial of his own mortality. Kylar released the prince and tried to step away, but his limbs refused to obey him. His knee buckled, and he crashed to the ground with the Caladoran prince. Roth and Kylar lay eye to eye on the marble at the foot of the throne, staring at each other, dying. Each trembled as uncontrollable twitches ran through his limbs. Each breathed terrible, labored breaths in time with the other. Roth's eyes brimmed with fear, panic so intense it paralyzed. He seemed to no longer see Kylar lying inches away. His gaze grew more distant and filled with soul-deep terror. Kylar was content. This night angel had apportioned death, and death was his portion. It wasn't nice, but it was just. This sentence was deserved. Watching Roth's eyes finally glaze in restless death, Kylar wished there was something more beautiful to find in death than justice, but he didn't have the strength to turn away from this life, this death, this terrible justice. Then, someone turned him over. A woman. She came into focus slowly. It was Eileen. She pulled Kylar into her lap, stroked his hair. She was crying. Kylar couldn't see her scars. He reached a hand up, touched her face. She was angelic. Then he saw his hand. It was perfect, whole, and amazingly, unbloodied. For the first time in his life, his hands were clean. Clean. Death came. Kylar yielded. Chapter 66. Tara Grayson had just paid a fortune to one of the prettiest men she'd ever seen. Jarl said he spoke for the Shinga, but he carried himself with such assurance, she wondered if he might not be the Shinga himself. She hadn't liked handing over so much money to the Sakage, but she hadn't had any choice. The God King's army would arrive with the dawn, and she'd already spent too long in the city. The coup had not gone according to the God King's plan. The Caladorans controlled the bridges, the castle, and the city's gates. But some of them had only skeleton crews. That would change when the rest of the army arrived, and Tara Grayson and her nobles needed to be gone when that happened. If she hadn't paid half her fortune to Jarl, she would have had to leave behind all of it. A queen made the hard decisions, and with everyone else dead, a queen was what she was now. It was midnight. The wagons were packed. The men were waiting. It was time. Tara stood outside her family's mansion. Like the other ducal families' homes, theirs was old, a veritable fortress. A looted fortress now. A looted fortress smelling of the barrels and barrels of oil they had poured in every room, over the precious heirlooms too heavy to carry, and into the grooves they'd cut in every centuries-old beam. It was time. Jarl's wet boys were supposed to slaughter the Caladorans holding the city's east gate at midnight. All the other nobles were huddled outside their own houses. From her elevated front porch, she could see some of them up and down Horax Street, waiting to see if she'd really do it. She locked the mansion in her mind. After she returned, she would rebuild this for her family, twice as splendid as before. Tara Grayson walked to the street and took the torch from Sergeant Gamble. The archers gathered around her. She personally lit every arrow. At her nod, they loosed them. The mansion went up in flame. Fire poured from the windows and reached for the heavens. Queen Terra Grayson didn't look. She mounted her horse and led her column, her pathetic army of 300 soldiers and twice as many servants and shopkeepers, into the street toward the east gate. Across the east side, the great houses lit up one by one. They were the funeral pyres of fortunes. Not only were the nobles losing everything, but so too were all those who depended on them for their employment. But the fires of destruction were also beacons of hope. "You may have won," Cenaria was saying, "but your victory is no triumph. You can force me from my home, but you will not live in it. I will leave you nothing but scorched earth." In response to those great fires across the city, smaller fires rose too. Shopkeepers set fire to their shops. Blacksmiths stoked their furnaces so hot they would crack. Bakers destroyed their ovens. Millers sank their millstones in the Plith. Warehouse owners set fire to their storehouses. Livestock owners slaughtered their herds. Captains, confined to the Plith by witches' magic, scuttled their own ships. Thousands joined the exodus. The trickle of nobles and their servants became a flood. The flood became a host, an army marching out of the city, marching in defeat, but marching. Some drove wagons. Some rode. Some walked barefoot with empty hands and empty bellies. Some cursed. Some prayed. Some stared over their shoulders with haunted eyes. Some wept. Some left brothers and sisters and parents and children, but every one of Cenaria's orphaned sons and daughters carried a small, dim hope in their hearts. "I shall return," it vowed. "I shall return." Neff stood as far to one side as he could among the maesters, generals, and soldiers, waiting to greet God King Gareth or Sul as he rode across West Kingsbridge with his retinue. The God King wore a great ermine cloak that accentuated the paleness of his northern skin. His chest was bare aside from the heavy gold chains of his office. He was robust, thick-bodied but muscular, vigorous for his age. The God King pulled his stallion to a halt before the courtyard gate. 6 heads on pikes greeted him. A 7th pike stood empty.
"Commander Gare!"
"Yes, my liege, my god, your highness, sire." The former royal guard cleared his throat. Things were not good. Though Roth's and Neff's plans had seemed to go without a problem, somehow the God King's armies had sustained far heavier losses than they'd planned. A boatload of Highlanders dead. Many of the nobles who ought to be dead escaped. Great swathes of the city aflame. The heart of Cenaria's industry and economy reduced to ashes. There was no resistance yet, but with so many nobles still alive, it would come. The maesters that were supposed to have been a devastating spearhead into the heart of Modai were now dead. More than 50 maesters dead at a stroke without any explanation except rumors of some mage with more talent than anyone else since Ezra the Mad and Jorsan Alcestis. The Siurin invasion ended before it began. The God King's son murdered just as he completed his Urtan. The Sakage would have to be brought to heel. Fires, literal and figurative, would have to be put out. Someone would have to answer for it. Neff Dada was trying to figure out how to make sure it wasn't him.
"Why is there an empty pike on my bridge?"
the God King asked.
"Anyone?"
Commander Hurin Gare shifted in his saddle, stupidly looking at the empty pike.
"We haven't found Prince's, I mean, the Pretender's, Logan Gyre's body yet, sire. We do know that he's dead. We have 3 reports confirming his death, but in all the fighting, we're working on it."
"Indeed."
God King Ursul didn't look at Hurin Gare. he was studying the faces of the royal family above him.
"And this shadow that killed my son? He's dead, too?"
Neff felt a chill at the quiet menace in the God King's query. When the Caladorans had first gone into the throne room, they thought some elite unit must have wiped out all the Caladorans in the room, but Neff had been able to revive a man who'd had his feet cut off. He swore he'd seen most of the fight before he passed out. It was one man. A shadow. The Night Angel, he called him. The story was already getting out among the men. A man who walked unseen, who could kill 30 Highlanders and 5 Meisters and one of the God King's own Ethlings. A man impervious to steel and to magic. It was nonsense, of course. With all the blood they'd found, the man must be dead. But without a body.
"Someone dragged his body away, sir. We followed the blood trail through the hidden passages. It was a lot of blood, sire. If it really was just one man, he's dead."
"It seems we have a lot of dead people without bodies, Commander. Find them. In the meantime, put up another head. Preferably one that looks like Logan Gyres."
It wasn't fair. Feral Caelius had been among the first Highlanders on Cenarian soil. He'd been one of the few to get off the burning, sinking barge, and that only because he'd had the wits to throw off his armor before jumping in. So he didn't drown like so many others had. He'd joined another unit and fought bare-handed until he could arm himself from the Highlanders who died in the first assault on the courtyard. He'd personally killed 6 Cenarian soldiers and 2 nobles, 6 nobles if you counted children, which he didn't. And what had he been given to recognize his heroism, his cunning? The shit duty. Certain units were being given looting privileges. The good units on the west side, what the barbarians called the warrens, and the best units looting the remains of the east side with the officers. Feral's unit was all dead, so he got assigned with clearing the rubble on the east bridge. It wasn't only dirty, it was dangerous. The witches had extinguished the fire, but many of the planks were weak, some of them cracking or breaking if you stood on them. The pilings were fine, sheathed in iron. They were impervious to fire. But you couldn't stand on the pilings, so a fat lot of good that did. The worst part of the job was the bodies. Some of them were like seared steak, crusted black on the outside and cracked and oozing on the inside, and the stench of burnt flesh and burnt hair. He was picking through the bodies, taking whatever looked promising and dumping the bodies over the side of the bridge. Some of the units would be glad to have their dead back for proper burial, but Feral wasn't going to carry the damned stinking things across this bridge. To the abyss with them. Then he saw a sword. It must have been under one of the bodies when the fire had started, because it was untouched. There wasn't even smoke damage on the hilt. It was a beautiful blade, the hilt carved with dragons. It was the kind of sword that befitted the leader of a war band, or a warlord. With such a sword, Feral's clan would hold him in awe he deserved. He was supposed to bring anything unusual he found to one of the Verdmeisters. Sure, after how well they've treated me. Looking at the other men working on the bridge and seeing that none were watching, he drew his sword, set it aside, and slid his prize into its sheath. Not a perfect fit, but good enough for the moment. The hilt was a problem. What with those dragons? But he'd wrap leather bindings around it soon enough. He was good with his hands. Give him a few hours and this sword would look like any other. The sword brightened his outlook considerably. It wasn't really enough to repay his valor, but it was a start. The Meister walked down the last corridor to what the southern barbarians called Hell's Asshole. The nauseating, intoxicating wash of torment engulfed her. She missed a step and stumbled against the wall. The soldier accompanying her turned. He looked scared.
"It's nothing," she said.
She walked to the grate covering the hole. A few words and red light burned in front of her. The creatures in the hole squinted and shrank back. She spoke again, and the light descended into the hole. She examined each prisoner. 10 men, 1 woman, and 1 simpleton with filed teeth. None of them could be the usurper. She turned, slightly dizzy, and walked out, trying not to flee. A minute later, a big man rolled out from an overhang carved in the stone. The woman looked at him and shook her head.
"You're a fool. Nothing they could do to you would be as bad as staying here. Look at you. You're soft. The hole will break you."
13. Logan stared at her flatly. A grimy woman with gaping holes in her dress, short a few teeth. The look on her face was the only thing approaching human kindness that was to be found in this hole.
"Though all the detritus of humanity pass through this hole, and all the fires of perdition rise from it, I will not be broken," Logan said.
"He uses a lot of big words, don't he?"
the big man named Finn said. He smiled a smile full of bloody gums, one of the first symptoms of scurvy, and wrapped his sinew rope back around his body.
"Lot of meat on that big fucker. We'll eat real good."
Scurvy meant food deficiencies. Food deficiencies meant Finn had lived long enough to get sick from food deficiencies. Finn was a survivor. Logan turned his eyes to him and pulled out his knife. Literally, his only edge against these animals.
"Let me make this real simple," he said,
having to stifle the impulse to say "really" instead of "real."
"You will not break me. The hole will not break me. I will not break. I will not be broken."
"What's your name, love?"
the woman asked. Logan found himself grinning. Something fierce and primal was rising inside him. Something inside him said, "Where others have failed, have faltered, have fallen, I will be triumphant. I am different. I am cut of a new cloth. I will rise.
Call me king," he said,
and he smiled a fuck you through the angst and the sorrow. And he was potent. That was it. That was survival. That was the secret. That was the living flame hidden in the ashes of his burned-out heart. If only he could hold it. Epilogue. Eileen knocked on the door of the Cooper's shop. Her hair covered, back bent, and foot twisted sideways in the dust. The Caladoran army had arrived yesterday, and King Garath Orsul was rewarding his troops for their valor by allowing selected soldiers to take what they desired. It wasn't a good day to be a pretty woman on the streets of Cenaria. It had taken her 2 harrowing days to find this place. The Cooper unbolted the door and signaled her in, gesturing to the back of the shop. Jarl was at a table covered with papers, fat sacks of money at his feet.
"I found your way out," he said. "A Caladoran caravan master has agreed to take you. You'll have to lie in a compartment used to smuggle Barush tea and worse things until you get outside the gates, but it's big enough to hold you and the girl. You leave at nightfall."
"You can trust this smuggler," Eileen said.
"I can't trust anyone," Jarl said, exhausted. "He's Caladoran and you're beautiful, but because he's Caladoran, he has the best chance of getting through the gates, and he's worked with us for 20 years. I've made it in his best interest to take you safely."
"You must have paid him a fortune," Eileen said.
"Only half of one,"
Jarl said, the shadow of a smile coming to his lips. The other half he gets when you send me word that you've made it safely. Thank you. It's the least I could do for Kylar. Jarl looked down, ashamed. It's also the most I can do. Eline hugged him. It's more than enough. Thank you. The girl's downstairs. She won't leave his bu- She won't leave him. He recognized this place. The white gold warmth suffused him. His flesh gloried in the light. He moved through the tunnel with sure and easy steps, eagerness, without hurry. Gentle fingers closed his eyes. A child shrieked. Regrets. Sorrow. Darkness. Cold. He blinked away the nightmare, breathed, let the white gold light hold him again.
Grab his arm, Uli. Help me.
Cold stone slid under his back. Discomfort, pain, hopelessness. Then even the cold and the jostling faded. He walked forward unsteadily in the tunnel, broke into a jog. This was where he belonged now, here, without pain. A tear splashed on his face. A woman spoke, but he couldn't make out the words. He stumbled and fell. He lay there, terrified, but the nightmare didn't come back. He got up to his knees, stood. At the next step, he smacked up against... nothing. He put his hands out and felt the invisible barrier. It was as cool as iron and as smooth as glass. Beyond it, the warmth increased. The white gold light beckoned him. Were those people up ahead? Something was pulling him aside, away. He felt twisted, and slowly a chamber came into focus. Not the chamber, for the chamber itself remained indistinct. It seemed full of people, intensely curious to see him, but he couldn't make them out. All that was truly in focus was a man seated before him on a low throne, and two doors. The door at his right hand was of beaten gold. Light leaked around every edge, the same warm white gold light Kylar had just been in. The door to his left hand was plain wood with a simple iron latch. The man's face was dominated by lambent, lupine yellow eyes. He wasn't tall, but he exuded authority, potency.
"What is this place?"
Kylar asked. A toothy smile.
"Neither heaven nor hell. This, if you will, is the antechamber of the mystery. This is my realm. Who are you?" "It pleased Achilles to call me the Wolf."
"Achilles? You mean Durzo?" Kylar asked.
"Before you there is a choice. You may proceed through one door or the other. Choose the gold, and I will release you back to where you just were, and you will have my apology for interrupting your journey."
"My journey?"
"Your journey to heaven, or hell, or oblivion, or reincarnation, or whatever it is that death holds."
"Do you know?" Kylar asked.
"This is the antechamber of the mystery, Azoth. You will find no answers here, just choices."
The Wolf grinned, and it was a joyless grin, a predatory grin.
"Through the wood door you will go back to your life, your body, your time. Or nearly so. It will take a few days for your body to heal. You will be the Night Angel in truth, as Achilles was before you. Your body will be immune to the scourge of time as Achilles's was, something that perhaps one must become old to appreciate. You will also heal at a rate beyond that of mortal men. What you call your talent will grow. You can still be killed. The difference is, you will come back. You will be a living legend.
It sounded wonderful. Too good, even. I'd be like a Kalis Thorn. I'd be like Durzo. The latter thought gave him pause. The burden of immortality, however it worked, or the power of it, or sheer press of so much time, was what had turned a Kalis Thorn, the prince, the hero, into Durzo Blint, the hopeless, bitter murderer. He remembered his snide remark to Durzo. "Here I thought the Night Angels were invincible."
"They're immortal. It's not the same."
"Why would you do this for me?" Kylar asked.
"Perhaps I don't do anything at all. Perhaps it is the Kakari's work."
"What's the price?"
"Ah, Durzo has taught you well, hasn't he?"
The wolf looked almost mournful.
"The truth is, I don't know. I can only tell you what I have heard from those more enlightened than I. They believed that coming back from death as you would was such a violation of the natural order of things that this unnatural life cost the afterlife. That for his 7 centuries of life, a Kalis traded all eternity. But they might be wrong. It might have no influence on eternity whatsoever, or there may be no eternity to influence. I'm the wrong man to ask. For I have chosen this life for myself."
Kylar walked toward the golden door.
It was so beautiful there. He'd had such peace. What fool would trade the eternal peace and happiness in that gold light for the blood and gore and dishonor and despair and duplicity of the life he'd led? As he stepped closer to it, the door changed. The gold melted, puddled to the ground in an instant, and a raging inferno leapt up, eager to devour Kylar. Then it was gone, and the gold door was back. Kylar shot a look at the wolf.
"Eternity," the wolf said, "might not be a pleasant place for you."
"You did that?"
"A simple illusion. But if you sat in judgment of Kylar Stern, would you give him eternal paradise?"
"You're not exactly disinterested in my choice, are you?"
"You've become a player, Night Angel. No one is disinterested in your choice."
How long Kylar stood there, he didn't know. All he knew was that if he made the wrong choice, he might have a very, very long time to regret it. The mathematical formulae were no help. They were full of infinities and zeros, with no way of knowing on which side of the equation they landed. There was no hedged bet when you might be throwing away eternity in paradise, or avoiding eternity in hell, or taking an eternal existence on earth with all its flaws, weighed against merciful oblivion. Kylar didn't have Count Drake's faith in a loving god, or Durzo's faith that there was no such god. He knew that he had done a lot of evil, by anyone's definition. He knew that he had done some good. He'd given his life for Eline.
Eline. She filled his mind and his heart so utterly that it ached. If he chose life, even if she accepted him, she would grow old and die in the smallest fraction of his life. The odds were that she never would accept him. Never could. All the ifs and maybes rose and fell in great towers of foundationless suppositions, but Eline remained. Kylar loved her. He always loved her. Eline was the risk he would take every time. He made his choice and ran toward the plain door. He screamed and jerked upright. Eline screamed. Uli screamed. Taking huge, gasping breaths, Kylar ripped open his blood-encrusted tunic. His chest was smooth, the skin perfect. He touched his demolished shoulder. It was whole, as healthy as the fingers of his right hand. There wasn't a scar on his body. He sat there blinking, not even glancing at Uli or Eline, who were frozen, staring at him.
I'm alive.
I'm alive?
Yes, Kylar,
Mama Kay said, coming into the room. Her calm was surreal. Kylar sat stupidly for a moment. It had all been real. He said, unbelievable. Kylar, one who kills and is killed.
Durzo knew all along.
Uli, seeming to take her cue from the calm Kylar and Mama Kay were showing, seemed to be fine with Kylar sitting up and talking when he'd been dead a moment before. Eline was not doing well. She stood up abruptly and walked out the door.
Eline, wait!
Kylar said.
Wait. Just tell me one thing.
She stopped and looked at him, confused, terrified, and hopeful at the same time. Her eyes full of tears.
Who was it who gave you those scars?
It wasn't Durzo, was it? It was Rat, right?
You come back from the dead to ask me that? Of course it was Rat.
She fled.
Wait, Eline, I'm sorry.
He tried to move, but it seemed he'd used up all his strength to sit up. She was gone.
Wait, what the hell am I sorry about?
Uli looked at Kylar accusingly.
You aren't going to let her go, are you?
Kylar held on to the edge of the bed like a lifeline. He looked at Uli and raised a hand helplessly and had to quickly put it down to keep from falling over.
How can I stop her?
Uli stomped her foot and stormed out of the room. Mama Kay was laughing, but it was a different laughter than he'd heard from her before. Deeper, fuller, truly happy. As if with the same act of will that had made her choose life, she'd set aside her cynicism.
I know what you're thinking, Kylar.
Durzo lied to you when he told you he'd hurt Eline.
Of course he did.
It was the only way he could save you. You had to kill him to succeed him. The Kakari couldn't complete the bond until its former master died. They sat there in silence, Kylar thinking of how Durzo's death cast his life in a completely different light. It was disconcerting to think how wrong he'd been about his master, thinking him so hateful, actually believing Durzo was capable of mutilating Doll Girl. But Kylar liked the picture that was emerging. Durzo Blint, the legend, had been a Kalis Thorn, the hero. Kylar wondered how many other heroes' names his master had worn. He felt a stabbing pain, an emptiness in his stomach, a surge toward tears that he suppressed.
I'm going to miss him,
he said, his throat tight. Mama Kay's eyes mirrored his.
Me too. But it's going to be all right. I don't know why, but I really believe that.
Kylar nodded.
So you decided to live,
he said, blinking tears away. He didn't want to break down in front of Mama Kay.
And so did you.
She arched an eyebrow at him, somehow holding both grief and happiness and amusement in her eyes all at once.
She loves you, Kylar, whether she realizes it or not. She dragged you out of the castle by herself. She refused to leave you. Jarl's men found her. It was only when they got you here that Uli saw your wounds were healing.
She's furious with me, Kylar said.
Furious the way a woman in love gets.
I know. Have you told Uli who her mother is? Kylar asked.
No. And I never will.
I won't raise her into this. She needs a family.
I was hoping you and Eline would be interested in the job.
Night came to the east shore of the Plith River, in a smothering cloud. The city had been burning all day, and the night winds wafted the smell over the entire city. Fires reflected in the plith, and low-hanging clouds held the ashy air like a pillow against the face of the city. A wagon clattered down a street, its driver hunched, face muffled against the malodorous air. He overtook a crippled woman with a bent back and a foot turned sideways.
"What up?"
his scratchy voice asked. The woman turned expectantly. Her face, too, was muffled, but her eyes were young, though both eyes had been blackened. Her Caladoran driver was supposed to be dark-haired and fat. This man was white-haired, lean as a rail, stooped, and almost lost in his clothes. She shook her head and turned away.
"Please, Aline?"
Kylar asked with his own voice. She flinched.
"I should be scared of you, shouldn't I?"
"I'd never hurt you," he said. Eyebrows above the eyes he'd blackened lifted incredulously. "Well, not really hurt you."
"What are you doing?"
she asked, looking around. There was no one else out on the streets.
"I'd like to take you away from here,"
Kylar said, brushing back his bleached hair and smiling through his makeup.
"You and Uli both, we can go anywhere. I'm going to pick her up next."
"Why me, Kylar?"
He was dumbfounded.
"It's always been you. Don't say you love me," she said. "How can you love this?"
She jerked the scarf down and pointed at her scars.
"How could you love a freak?"
He shook his head.
"I don't love your scars, Aline. I hate them."
"And you'll never see past that."
"I'm not finished," he said.
"Aline, I've watched over you since we were children. For a long time, you're right, I couldn't see past your scars. I'm not going to give you some crap that they're beautiful. Your scars are ugly. But you aren't, Aline. The woman I see when I look at you is amazing. She's smart, she's got a quick tongue, and she's got such a heart that it makes me believe that people can be good despite all I've seen to the contrary for my whole life."
His words were sinking into her, he could tell.
"Oh, Mama Kay, tell me I learned something about words from you. Tell me I learned something despite myself."
Aline's hands waved like little birds.
"How can you say that? You don't know me."
"Aren't you still doll girl?" Her hands came down, the little birds fluttering to rest.
"Yes,"
she said.
"But I don't think you're still Azoth."
"No," he admitted. "I'm not. I don't know who I am. Right now I only know I'm not my master, and I won't live like he did." Hope seemed to leech out of her.
"Kylar," she said.
And he saw that the name was a deliberate choice.
"I will always be grateful to you. But we would be a disaster. You would destroy me."
"What are you talking about?"
"Mama Kay said your master intercepted all my letters."
"Yes, but I've had a busy afternoon catching up," Kylar said. She smiled sadly.
"And you still don't understand?"
"Do girls ever make sense?" He shook his head.
"When we were children, you were the one who protected me, who looked out for me. You were the one who put me with a real family. I wanted to be with you forever. Then, when I was growing up, you were my benefactor who made me special. You were my secret young lord whom I loved so desperately and so foolishly. You were my Kylar, my poor nobleman that the Drake girls told me stories about. Then, you were the one who came to save me in jail."
He paused and paused. "You say that like it's a bad thing."
"Oh, Kylar,
What happens to that silly girl when it turns out I'm not good enough for the man I've loved for my whole life?
You not good enough?
It's a fairy tale, Kylar. I don't deserve it. Something will happen. You'll find somebody prettier, or you'll get tired of me, and then you'll